Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Navigating Autism, 9 Mindsets for Helping Kids on the Spectrum, by Temple Grandin, Ph.D., and Deborah Moore, Ph.D., narrated by Laurel Merlington. Publisher's Note: In this audio edition, you will hear references to figures and tables present in the print and ebook formats of the book. Preface. When I was in elementary school, my ability in art was always encouraged. My mother always urged me to paint and draw many different things instead of creating a single horse head over and over. To determine what a child or adult is good at and likes requires exposure to a variety of activities. Today I am seeing too many kids who have never been exposed to using tools, playing musical instruments, or performing in a play. I get asked all the time what led me into a career in the cattle industry. The answer is real simple. I experienced the West in cattle when I visited my aunt's ranch at age 15. Both children and adults get interested in things they are exposed to. They may also try something new and find out that they hate it. But it is important to learn what a child likes and dislikes by trying many different things. My mother had a really good instinct on how to stretch me a little bit outside my comfort zone to try something new. She always gave me a choice. When the opportunity to go to my aunt's ranch arrived, she gave me a choice. I could stay all summer or stay only 1 week. I got out to the ranch and loved it and chose to stay all summer. Too many kids with an autism label are overprotected by their parents. They are not learning basic skills, such as shopping or handling money. Many grandparents have told me that they discovered that they are on the autism spectrum when their grandchildren are diagnosed. In most cases, the grandparent had a job at a young age, such as delivering newspapers. They learned how to work long before they graduated from high school. Teachers and parents need to find substitutes for the old paper routes. Some possibilities for 11 to 12-year-olds are volunteer jobs at a religious organization or farmer's market. Autistic individuals will often have uneven skills. They will be good at one thing and bad at another. I am an object visualizer who thinks in pictures. This enabled me to understand animals and be good at design and building things. Another autistic person may be a pattern, mathematical, visual, spatial thinker. These people may excel at engineering and computer programming. A third type is the verbal thinker. Autism is a very broad spectrum, ranging from a brilliant head of a major tech company to somebody with much more severe challenges. I love the Stephen Hawking quote, "Concentrate on the things your disability does not prevent you from doing well." Temple Grandin, Professor of Animal Science, Colorado State University. Introduction. Temple and I share like-minded views when it comes to autism and children on the spectrum. We both put more value on potential than struggles. We emphasize the importance of strengths versus deficits. And when we see a child or teen with autism, we both see countless fascinating facets just waiting to be developed. We decided to work together on navigating autism so we could share and more fully explain our views. We wanted to give you examples based both on Temple's own personal life and on my many years counseling individuals and families impacted by autism. We strongly believe that if the adults interacting with autistic children stay grounded in the mindsets presented in this book, each child has a much improved chance of reaching their fullest potential than otherwise. In addition to our own perspectives, we've added the findings of scientific studies so that you can feel comfortable knowing our viewpoints are rooted in and confirmed by research. We've also included lots of checklists and practical suggestions to help you put the mindsets into concrete, tangible action. We hope you already see each child with autism as more than a label. After listening to this book, we hope you'll broaden that outlook and consistently integrate it into all of your evaluations and interventions. Whether you are an educator, medical provider, mental health counselor, or parent, you have the immense obligation and opportunity to change how others view autistic children. When you accept, embrace, and foster the uniqueness of each child you encounter, you shift that child's sense of themselves. When you stay focused on strengths, passions, and possibilities, then they and everyone around them can too. Mindset 1. Every child is more than autism. We live in a world of labels. We use them, diagnostic and otherwise, to make the world more comprehensible. When we agree on criteria for a diagnosis, we have a way to talk to each other in shorthand. We know what we mean. For example, if we say a child has restricted, repetitive behaviors, because that is spelled out in the current diagnostic and statistical manual. But labels also have drawbacks. When we label someone, others start to see them through the filter of that label. When we use the term autism, some people have an accurate understanding of the word, but many others do not. Even professionals have their own notions of what autism looks like. Once the label is used, they will apply that image. This happens to a lot of people with autism. Once we label someone, we also risk creating an oversimplified snapshot of that person. Once a person gets labeled, people's opinion of that person may never change. But everyone, with or without a label, is always developing and evolving. Many of these changes are subtle and easy to miss. Seeing a child through the filter of a label may make it more likely we'll miss the small changes. No matter what role you play in the life of a child with autism, professional, educator, or parent, you should always look beyond labels and see all of their strengths and features. People who realize that a diagnosis of autism describes only part of a child, by definition, only the deficits and impairments, are in the best position to help, teach, and nurture that child. They also have better odds of imparting helpful tools when they view that child as a complex, multifaceted person with unique interests, temperaments, and abilities. The diagnosis of autism can sometimes help you better predict a child's behaviors, but it tells you nothing about their specific way of thinking, their idiosyncrasies, their strengths, or their individual personality. A wise clinician, educator, or parent must look beyond diagnosis and appreciate all aspects of the child so they can help them develop an identity based on more than just being autistic. An accurate view of any child's personality includes their talents and strengths. Their personality is not defined by autism. Every child is more than autism. By the end of this chapter, we hope you are quicker to recognize when you or anyone involved with an autistic child falls into the label trap. We'll help you get there by pointing out the many variables that shape a child, and we'll also introduce you to 4 tendencies that can limit or bias your understanding of them. Everyone, even well-trained professionals, can let unconscious biases skew their view of someone with autism. We'll bring these tendencies to life by giving you sample vignettes of children that illustrate how a professional or parent might see that child if the adult is trapped by any of these viewpoints. Then we'll give you suggestions to step outside each trap. We'll also show you how the media has influenced our views of autism. One of the biggest factors that determines how a person views autism is their age. That's because their ideas about autism were shaped by the media images that were popular while they were growing up. If your first exposure to autism was the movie Rain Man, you may have a very different perspective than if you grew up watching the Netflix series Atypical. We'll also share ways of viewing autism that go beyond the list of diagnostic criteria in the DSM-5. This will help you look for more than whether a child exhibits behavior necessary for a diagnosis. To really understand and help a child, you have to think about how their brain systems function and how they process information. Your assessment of a child with autism is also filtered through your particular academic training. Specialists often overemphasize their own area of interest and minimize other contributions to a child's functioning. We'll detail how different groups of professionals tend to focus on different aspects of a child. Even good approaches and interventions can fail if you don't appreciate all aspects of a child. By adding the mindsets in this book to your repertoire, you will be better equipped to maintain a broad perspective, conduct more useful evaluations, put interventions on concrete foundations, recognize obstacles unrelated to autism, and bring out a child's strengths. Using the 9 mindsets will help you see more progress and bring out each child's unique and maximum potential. Recognize the difference between traits and temporary states and autism. We all have individual traits, innate, inborn reactions to stress, novelty, and people. When a person is labeled autistic, we may attribute their traits to their developmental condition, but this shouldn't be our automatic assumption. Their traits, be it shyness, fearfulness, curiosity, or lack of curiosity, might be equally strong even if they were not autistic. We all experience states, temporary moods, reactions, and mindsets. We usually don't emphasize or dwell on the temporary states of people, but when someone has a label, we're more likely to attribute their temporary state to that label, even if it is unrelated. We don't realize we do this. It is an unconscious, automatic reaction. Once someone is given a label, in fact, a cascade of events can happen. As described, those closest to the person, such as family or professionals, may filter their perceptions through that label. They may begin to mistakenly attribute traits and behaviors to the labeled condition, and they may begin to organize their view of the person according to their understanding of the label. They may also begin to make the label the most important part of that person. When this happens, others in the child's environment tend to do the same. Here is one example. The first thing 14-year-old George's parents announce when they introduce their son is that he is autistic. They know George comes across as different, and they worry what others will think. They've had lots of experiences of George being misunderstood or bullied, and their intention is to prevent others from causing him further hurt. They have been his protectors for so long, it's become automatic. They don't realize by putting George's label first, and not mentioning any of his other characteristics, they are shortchanging their son. The announcement of his label doesn't protect him. Instead, it will often shift and restrict how others see him. By leading with a label, George's parents imply autism is the most important part of him. They probably don't intend to do that. It is hoped that they see their son as a complex teen with a variety of strengths and challenges, just like any other boy his age. Some of those challenges and strengths are related to autism, but some are not. By preempting the opportunity for others to get to know George by their own observations and interactions with him, they deprive both George and others of a fuller, richer experience. George's parents would never want him to be referred to as the Smith's son with autism, yet that might be what people tend to remember and even repeat to others. Because a label was their first framework for George, it may be how they think or speak of him from then on. His parents unwittingly spread an incomplete, distorted image of George. Professionals, too, can fall into overemphasizing labels to the detriment of the person they are trying to help. Here is an example from the academic environment. Mrs. Whittington is a talented high school guidance counselor. She has been with the school district close to 20 years. She has helped scores of children and families and is respected by her colleagues. She would never intend to limit or curb a child's potential. When helping seniors plan for their futures, she often assists them in drafting letters to potential trade schools, colleges, and employers. She believes that when a child has a disability, they should get all available resources, so she emphasizes their needs. She wrote a letter of recommendation for Tyler, a student applying for a computer store job. She highlighted his autism. She wanted his prospective employer to be informed. She thinks it will help the company better understand his behaviors. While a worthy goal, she goes about it in a way that could limit Tyler's odds of getting hired. The first sentence of her letter disclosed, with his permission, that Tyler was autistic. She explained his challenges and described how he may be misunderstood by others. Later in the letter, she mentioned how far Tyler has come and says he would be a loyal, positive addition to their workforce. By labeling Tyler right away, Mrs. Whittington made his autism sound like the biggest part of him. His punctuality, work ethic, and intense enthusiasm for all things computer-related were unintentionally relegated to secondary characteristics. Yet it is those qualities that Tyler has to offer. His autism is secondary. She could have more appropriately included Tyler's autism within the larger context of a multifaceted young man, or she could have left it out entirely, while still describing his challenges and strengths accurately. There are valid arguments on both sides of the question of disclosing a diagnosis to prospective employees, but it rarely, if ever, should take center stage. If you do want to disclose autism because you think it will help someone, embed the label within a full description of the person. Clarify why it is being disclosed and how the information can be put to good use. Here's an example of how you could go about this. Dr. Moore once worked with Natalie, a young woman who wanted to get an apprenticeship as a brick mason. An interview was required as part of the application. Natalie did not interview well. In fact, she did quite poorly in these situations. If an interviewer spoke fast or in idioms or slang, Natalie couldn't always grasp what was meant. She couldn't respond as quickly as most interviewers expected. She didn't pick up on subtleties of the social aspect of the interview, and she was lousy at small talk. she came across as too serious and awkward. To help prevent Natalie from creating a misleading impression of her abilities, Dr. Moore sent a brief advance email to the interviewer. The email suggested Natalie had unique gifts to bring to the apprenticeship. Dr. Moore listed this young woman's strengths. She was extremely detail-oriented, which fit perfectly with this field. She spotted errors faster than most people, again, a critical skill. And she could anticipate problems that others didn't foresee. She could envision creative, novel, and simple solutions to problems that stymied others. She was loyal, punctual, and honest, and she had no interest whatsoever in workplace politics or drama. Dr. Moore also wrote that Natalie often struck others as odd and was frequently perceived as aloof or uninterested. The email explained this was because Natalie focused so intently on her work that little else registered. If you wanted her attention, the email suggested, it was important to be clear, precise, and direct. The email ended by noting that Natalie rarely made a good first impression in interviews. The interviewer was told that she might take longer than most to respond to questions, due to her slower decoding and processing of information. The email explained that Natalie was methodical rather than impulsive, again, a necessary part of her chosen field, and that her brain digested data in a very linear, logical manner. Dr. Moore pointed out this was part of how Natalie's autism made her a uniquely well-suited applicant for the tasks involved in being a brick mason. Natalie was accepted as an apprentice. Perhaps the letter helped. What the letter did not do was create an image of an autistic applicant. The average listener would instead have come away with a general sense of Natalie and how she might fit into the program. Her autism, obviously part of that, did not take the lead. The email may have helped prevent Natalie's interviewer from getting stuck in what Temple calls label-locked thinking. These three examples of George, Tyler, and Natalie illustrate the importance of always treating each person as a complex, multifaceted individual with unique challenges, strengths, and interests. This mindset is the most important first step for professionals and parents who want to really understand or help someone with autism. If you remember that a diagnosis of autism describes only part of a child, by definition, only the deficits and impairments, you will be in the best position to help, teach, and nurture a child. Behavioral diagnoses and unconscious biases. Four tendencies that skew perceptions. Diagnostic labels exist to help clinicians and educators identify patients and students who exhibit common core features and thus benefit from similar interventions. Labels also give professionals and parents a way of talking to each other more easily. Not everything has to be explained in detail. A diagnostic term also provides consistent guidelines for researchers. Diagnoses can also restrict perception. This may be particularly true for diagnoses based on descriptions of behavior as opposed to medical markers. Although research is advancing our understanding of the genetic and biological underpinnings of autism, the current DSM-5 diagnostic criteria remain based solely on observable behavior. When we focus on behaviors, particularly ones deemed impaired or abnormal, we selectively magnify these parts of the person and minimize other important aspects. Social psychologist Solomon Ash conducted research with important implications for anyone working with autistic children. Ash wanted to find out what factors influence how we perceive and make sense of others. His findings have direct relevance for parents of autistic children, as well as the children's clinicians and educators. Ash found four tendencies that bias or limit our view of another person. We've paraphrased his language in order to make each tendency as clear and straightforward as possible. You are probably most vulnerable to these tendencies when you are stressed, tired, or engaged in a behavior so routine that you've gone on autopilot. Tendency number one. We like simple explanations of a child's behavior, and we ignore contradictory data. Jason, age 9 years, entered fourth grade at a new school after his family moved across town. He had been diagnosed with autism the year before, though his new teacher had not been informed. By the end of his first day in class, Jason's teacher had decided her new student was shy. She viewed Jason as an introvert who preferred being left alone. She attributed all of his behaviors to shyness. Many others in Jason's life see him the same way. The tendency to prefer simple explanations is universal. Clinicians, educators, and family members can all form remarkably fast impressions without even realizing it. We think these impressions help us predict someone's future behavior. In some cases, that's true. But drawing global conclusions is a disservice to children because it fails to predict more subtle or contradictory aspects of their personality. Some of Jason's behaviors that his teacher attributed to shyness were limited eye contact, restricted facial expressions, not joining in the loud laughter and chatter of his peers during recess, and standing unusually far away from the other kids while waiting in line for lunch. Jason also exhibited behaviors that were not symptomatic of an introvert. Ash's studies predict the teacher would overlook or discount these behaviors because they didn't match most of what she saw. For example, Jason made eye contact when his teacher talked about the weather, and he frowned when she used the word blizzard inaccurately. He knew that snow does not even need to be falling for a blizzard to occur, that the exact requirements for a blizzard are sustained winds that last 3 hours or longer, with frequent gusts to 35 miles per hour or greater, and either falling or blowing snow. Also, Jason's teacher probably missed his several attempts to socialize that first morning. Because his outreach to other children was awkward and subsequently rebuffed, Jason had quickly given up trying to interact with anyone. By afternoon, he had decided to keep to himself. Jason also struggled with sensory overload. He stood apart from his peers to avoid being brushed up against, a sensation that caused him both physical and emotional discomfort. He created unusual interpersonal distance not because he was inherently shy. He simply needed more personal space than the average child. If you were Jason's teacher or clinician, how could you have avoided the trap of making global inferences? Here are tips to help you appreciate a child's unique and varied nuances. Treat initial observations as unique data points. Do not rush to fit them into a pattern. Realize humans are wired to create patterns even where they do not exist. Think of the times you've seen images in clouds and how others may see something entirely different. Consciously resist this default tendency. When you observe a behavior, find out what happened before and after it. Understanding triggers and after effects can drastically change your interpretation of an act. For example, when Jason stood apart from his peers, his trigger was being jostled by a classmate, and the after-effect was a startled response, a grimace and fearful, wide eyes. If his teacher had noted these reactions, she might have suspected sensory sensitivity.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?